The following program is a PBS Wisconsin original production.
You're watching Here and Now 2024 election coverage.
We made a commitment to fix our broken student loan system because while a college degree still is a ticket to the middle class, that ticket's becoming much too expensive.
In a presidential visit to Wisconsin, Joe Biden releases his new plan for student loan debt relief. And in a surprise announcement, Justice Anne Walsh Bradley says she will not seek re-election in 2025, an election that could once again tip the balance of the Wisconsin Supreme Court.
I'm Frederica Freiber. Tonight on Here and Now, a look at the implications of Justice Walsh Bradley leaving the bench. Nathan Denzin reports on the rise of mass book challenges in K-12 school libraries. Then, why some parts of the state can't find candidates for local government. And finally, how smaller communities are dealing with the rise in people who lack housing. It's Here and Now for April 12.
Funding for Here and Now is provided by the Focus Fund for Journalism and Friends of PBS Wisconsin.
Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice Anne Walsh Bradley announced this week that she will not run for re-election when her term is up in 2025, a departure from statements she made a few months ago. This upset of the court could mean a conservative majority once again.
The three-term justice did not give specifics as to why she will not run again, only that in the 177-year history of the state, she said, only four justices will have served longer than my length of service. She went on to say, I know I can win re-election should I run, but it's just time to pass the torch, bringing fresh perspectives to the court. The announcement is another curveball for the court, as it's become a focal point for Wisconsin politics. It's also a 180 from statements she made in November, while in attendance at Janet Protasiewicz's election night party, when the balance of the court's ideology changed for the first time in her near 30-year tenure.
Do you have any idea of whether you'd want to run again?
And if absolutely going to run again. I do have an idea, and it is, yes, after tonight's performance and seeing the energy in this room, I'm not only going to run, I'm going to win.
In her time, she's presided over many important cases in the state, but a Legislative Reference Bureau survey of significant Wisconsin court decisions in 2020 said, quote, rarely have so many cases involving the core and essential powers of the state's political institutions been on the court's docket. And by 2022, it again stated, political conflict inevitably made its way onto the court's docket, a testament to the recent trend of high-profile issues turning to the court to make decisions. Despite the court justices officially being nonpartisan, last year's election between Dan Kelly and Janet Protasiewicz garnered a record $51 million as interests across the board poured money into the campaigns, setting the stage for another expensive election. As an incumbent, Justice Walsh Bradley would have had an edge over opponents. Candidates from both sides have expressed running in 2025.
Former Wisconsin Attorney General Republican Brad Schimmel has formally announced his run. In education news, Saturday marks the end of National Library Week, dedicated to getting young readers into the local libraries. But at the same time, Wisconsin schools and libraries have had to deal with more book challenges and bans than ever before, more than doubling in 2023. Here and Now reporter Nathan Denzin has more.
I would say our school librarians are under a lot of stress.
And it's this culture war of, you know, control, right?
I think there was 280-some books in the high school that were being challenged.
Even non-readers were coming up to me like, what is going on?
Wisconsin has seen a huge rise in book challenges since about 2021.
The inquiries are so strong that it actually has shifted the priorities of my position and made that one of the focus areas in support of our school librarians.
Monica Treptow is the Wisconsin Department of Instruction's school library media consultant. She travels around the state helping educators understand the current environment of book challenges.
There's been book challenges for decades, right? That's not a new thing. But it is new in that the techniques are different.
Those techniques are often spread on social media.
With social media, there's a lot of misinformation that is spread. Misinformation is designed, you know, to stoke outrage.
Dr. Jill Underley is the state superintendent of public instruction. She says apps like Facebook or X have contributed to the increasing number of challenges. According to the American Library Association, the number of titles challenged hit a record high in 2023. In Wisconsin, there were 27 challenges aimed at hundreds of books. Trepto said that a typical book challenge used to be over a single book. A concerned parent would bring it to a librarian or educator. In contrast, recent challenges include long lists of books that have been sent straight to district administrators or school boards.
For the middle school, it was over 600 pages long, and for the high school, I believe it was over 1,400 pages long.
You looked at it at first and you're like, oh my God.
We knew immediately there was no way to actually read all of the books.
Jason Tadlock, Dan Keel, and Ryan McBurney work in the Elkhorn School District. Tadlock is superintendent, Keel is the high school principal, and McBurney is the middle school principal. In late 2023, Elkhorn fielded a challenge to a whopping 444 books.
These two stacks represent about one-sixth of all of the books that were challenged in Elkhorn. District staff say it took months to sift through all of the material.
Titles like The Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck and The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo by Stieg Larsson were among the challenged material, as were books containing LGBTQ or race topics.
It wasn't just sex, it was drugs, it was abuse, it was, you know, any number of different topics.
The policy also required at that time and requires for those books to be pulled out of circulation until such a time a principal makes that judgment.
That caused about 160 books from the middle school and about 280 books from the high school to get temporarily pulled from shelves. In order to get information about all 444 books, the parent had pulled reviews off of booklooks.org. The site was previously affiliated with Moms for Liberty, which is considered a far-right anti-government organization by a group that tracks extremism in America.
The message that parents don't have primacy over their child's education has been prevalent for years, and for too long, we have stayed silent as out-of-touch administrators, school board members, and even union leaders behaved as parents aren't smart enough to choose what's right for their own children.
Scarlett Johnson is one of the founders of the Moms for Liberty chapter in Wisconsin. She has used social media to speak out against numerous books all over the state since 2020. Johnson did not respond to a request to be interviewed for this story. However, in a sit-down with WXOW in La Crosse, she pushed back against what she calls indoctrination.
We send kids to school to be educated, not indoctrinated, and also not we don't send them there for therapy.
In Madison, groups like the American Society for the Defense of Tradition, Family, and Property can be found protesting content in schools and libraries.
The literature that they're promoting in the libraries, a lot of it is pornographic or obscene.
Jonathan Marine is a member of the American TFP, which is an anti-LGBTQ organization.
These things should not be allowed in libraries.
Of course, parents should have say in what their kids are reading, but when we look at the challenges, it's really a subset of people are dictating what it is that you can read and what your kids can read.
In Elkhorn, staff had to take on extra duties in order to check every book that was challenged.
Principals, librarians, administrative assistants, directors, just kind of an all hands on deck to make sure that we're getting, with the sheer volume of it, getting as all that information together as much as possible.
We tried to do our best to get a kind of a consensus on where is this book, where should this book be rated age-wise.
To determine an appropriate age range, they used a combination of professional review sites to learn more about the content of each book. Ultimately, none of the books were banned because staff did not find any of the books to be objectionable. A handful of books were moved from the middle to the high school, and another handful had a grade or age restriction applied. Despite the long hours, district staff said that there was one positive. They learned more about each book in their school's library.
It's not bad for me to get into the library, see what's actually there, what are people concerned with.
But they also said it was a distraction for some of the students.
I think that it was disruptive. I think it created a lot of angst among students and or parents.
It brought a lot of attention and a lot of questions.
Rebecca Blum is the library media specialist for the Elkhorn High School.
Believe it or not, some of the circulation went up a little bit because they're like, oh, well, which books are on that list?
We had a lot of feedback from parents that, you know, how dare an individual determine or try to determine for me what's appropriate for my kid or not?
I would just say the more diverse selection we have in here, the more opportunity we have for these kids to really grow.
Libraries are places that are supposed to be safe. They're supposed to be inclusive for everybody.
In its core principle, there's nothing wrong with a book challenge. But when it goes to these extremes and you get people raising concerns in very either distant relationships to the school district or in mass amounts, then it turns into something that does threaten democracy.
Underly and Treptow say now is the time for districts around the state to review their book challenge policy.
Really important that our school districts look at their policies so that they can be prepared.
Tadlock also said the Elkhorn District is revising their challenge policy so one parent can't challenge a mass number of books.
It'll require up to 5 community members, and they'd like to have it that 5 individuals from different households would have to submit the challenge.
The policy will require the challenger to have read the book in full before submitting. The district also developed a form for parents that would give their student access to any restricted book.
Parents can say, you know, my kid can read the restricted books, and they're open and accessible to all kids.
My argument for that is sometimes, depending on what the book is, then maybe put that in the parents' hands and let them have those conversations with their kids.
We want our libraries to be that inclusive space for all of our students to be able to find the resources that they need.
What we're doing is keeping books in the hands of students so that they can support their learning.
For Here and Now, I'm Nathan Denzine in Elkhorn.
In a sign of the times, a candidate for Douglas County Board in Superior won 2 seats as a write-in in a spring election that had 4 board races without any candidate on the ballot. Our next guest has studied the declining interest in service in local government, especially in rural Wisconsin. David Halpap is a UW Green Bay professor of political science. Professor, thanks very much for being here.
You bet. Thank you for having me.
So how increasingly common and widespread is the kind of situation that we saw in Douglas County with too few people running for local office?
Well, I think what we've seen over the last few years is that there's just been sort of a declining interest in participating in politics more broadly. But when we start talking about rural areas, we have a situation where the population is declining in a lot of those areas. It's getting older, and there's been some significant concern from those who are currently in office that once they retire or move on from public service, that there really isn't going to be the next sort of cohort of individuals to take their place, that the next generation, the next group doesn't really have an interest in taking on that role.
Why doesn't the next generation want to step up in that way?
Most of these positions, the pay is limited or it is entirely voluntary. And so to take up time and to not be compensated for it, that can be difficult, particularly if you have a family. There is this need for social connection, for social capital, to have people involved, to feel like they're a part of a community and feel comfortable taking on those leadership roles within that community. And when that sense of community goes away, particularly in rural areas where there isn't a huge population anyway, and sort of that sense of community may not be there, or it may have declined over the years, that makes the situation even more challenging.
And meanwhile, many of these communities face rather daunting problems for which they need this kind of leadership. What are those kinds of particular issues related to rural local government that they're having to deal with?
A lot of the challenges that have been plaguing rural local governments for a long time continue to exist. So limited resources, lack of capacity, challenges with delivering good quality services. But then there are some more recent challenges like affordable housing. There was a lot of concern about just good quality, affordable housing in their community. Access to high-speed internet, substance abuse, those types of issues. And it is, I think, a challenge for some communities because there isn't necessarily that capacity there to address them or the expertise to address them. Where for larger communities that have been dealing with some of these problems for some time, that there's infrastructure in place to address it, but that may not be the case in smaller communities.
So what are the ideas about how to address this?
So getting, I think, more state support would help address the one of the biggest concerns. I think 98% of communities said that they could use more resources. Not surprising, right? But at the same time, there may be opportunities to partner with other local governments, counties. Counties in Wisconsin typically provide a lot of services anyway. I think there's this growing recognition that in order to solve a lot of the problems, big societal problems we have, regardless of if you're in an urban area or a rural area, that some of that cross-sector collaboration is needed, that you need to bring in multiple different levels of government, nonprofit organizations, private businesses, to really sort of move ahead with social welfare issues, infrastructure issues. It is valuable to have those types of partners.
All right. We leave it there. Professor David Helpap, thanks very much.
Yeah, you bet. Thank you for having me.
And this election year fact check tonight, a constitutional amendment on the November ballot in Wisconsin specifies that only a United States citizen age 18 or older may vote in an election for national, state, or local office or referendum. The amendment changes current constitutional language from every U.S. citizen to only a U.S. citizen. Republican authors of the language say it's needed because some states have allowed non-U.S. citizens to vote in local elections. With migration being a prime campaign issue, Donald Trump is pushing fears of non-citizens voting. But as Stephen Potter finds, this kind of voter fraud is vanishingly rare.
Our state issues valid driver's licenses to people who are non-citizens and are not eligible to vote. How do you catch that?
Convinced of fraud in the last election, people at a recent election education event in West Bend raised a worry over immigrants voting illegally in 2024.
In the last 5 years that the state of Wisconsin has issued driver's licenses to over 250,000 non-legal, illegal, whatever the right terminology is, immigrants in the state.
But that number refers to non-U.S. citizens who are legally present here as permanent residents or temporary visitors. The Wisconsin Department of Motor Vehicles has issued more than 258,000 driver's licenses and 41,000 photo ID cards to non-U.S. citizens since 2019. Those Wisconsin driver's licenses, or photo IDs, are stamped with limited term or non-domiciled unless the person is a permanent resident whose cards have no such stamp. A photo ID is required to vote in Wisconsin, but non-citizens cannot legally use their IDs or licenses to register and vote. Despite concerns that they are in large numbers, the Wisconsin Elections Commission says that since 2019, there have been 3 non-citizens who have been referred for prosecution for voting illegally, mostly misunderstanding their eligibility. The question of citizenship happens before anyone casts a ballot. When registering to vote, a person must certify under penalty of law that they're a U.S. citizen. Non-citizens risk being arrested, jailed, and deported if they do vote illegally. As to the question, how do you catch that? The Wisconsin Elections Commission told us there is no mechanism available to conduct real-time checks on a voter's citizenship status. No state or federal law requires the WEC or clerks to verify a voter's citizenship status. But they also said there is not evidence to support the idea that non-citizens are voting in Wisconsin in significant numbers. For Here and Now, I'm Stephen Potter.
Turning to western Wisconsin, in March, the city of La Crosse cleared 130 tons of abandoned items at long-term overnight camping sites along the Black River shoreline. The campsites and others are where people experiencing homelessness in La Crosse had taken up residence. As part of a five-year plan to end long-term homelessness, bans on camping on city property are already in place. But with nowhere to go, campers pop up on other sites. It's been a thorny problem for the city between trying to help the increasing number of unsheltered people in the aftermath of COVID and being responsive to community calls for action. La Crosse Mayor Mitch Reynolds joins us now, and thanks for being here.
I appreciate you having me on. Thanks so much.
So your Pathways Home Plan states that encampments will no longer be tolerated once your new homeless response system is up and running. Is that system up and running?
No, implementation of Pathways Home Plan began in January. And at this point, what we're doing is data collection. So that's the first part. And then we move on to the other parts that include where we identify the surge housing, how much we need our surge emergency shelter, how much we need, because we don't really want shelters. We want to move people directly from being unsheltered to a housing option immediately.
According to the city's documentation, there are about 200 individuals and 20 families experiencing chronic homelessness in La Crosse. Describe kind of the three prongs of the Pathways Home program to try to get people into permanent housing.
It's complicated, frankly. Mm-hmm. But, and just to be clear, you know, not everybody who is chronically homeless is living like in a tent in the marsh right now. We do have dozens of people who are living in various places throughout the city who are in, in various spots, like in the marsh and the forested areas and places that are not in La Crosse. A lot of people, and this is typical, we have people in our community who they may have temporary shelter with a friend or in a relative's spare bedroom or on a couch or something along those lines. We have families we've had a lot of issues with children who are homeless in the city of La Crosse for a really long time. I mean, part of this is really just in one of these areas of Pathways Home Plan is just trying to create more housing options in the city. And this work that we're doing all the time, and frankly, that's the most critical part of the Pathways Home Plan, is that providing adequate supportive services is another absolutely critical part. But the most important part of Pathways Home is having the city and the county be the ones who are driving the bus, being the ones who are managing the homeless response. This is just, it's almost exactly what the city and county of Milwaukee did. And in fact, I just talked to Hector Colon this morning, who is now head of Lutheran Social Services and was the executive director of Milwaukee County Health and Human Services. And they orchestrated that a path to almost functional zero in Milwaukee County by doing this very same thing. And from my perspective, that's the most critical part, is that the city and the county are, for the first time ever, getting together and really managing the response to homelessness. And we're not leaving it to private service agencies. We're directing traffic on this one. And I think that accountability, for me, that's the most critical part of it. But certainly, the providing supportive services and then providing adequate housing, finding that adequate housing, that is an absolutely essential part of this.
Because how hard is it for you as mayor to see this enduring problem?
Feels like failure every single day. That's how it feels. It's constant work. It's exhausting, but I'm not going to quit. It is absolutely critical for our community to address the needs of the most vulnerable. For those individuals and for our community as well. We have to be able to believe that we are a kind of community that looks out for those who are living on the edge of the abyss. It's critical work, and it's something I'm completely dedicated to. But yeah, Frederica, it feels like failure every single day.
Does the city and county of La Crosse have the capacity and resources to meet your goal of eliminating long-term homelessness by 2029?
We do. We need more. I mean, when I was speaking to Mr. Colon this morning, we were talking about the need for there to be community support through various donations, support through business, community organizations, individuals, that type of thing. It's going to take money. I think that's something that we'll be working on, but we have resources, but the county has personnel resources that they can utilize. They just had to shift focus away from homelessness and more towards the needs of the homeless individuals, their mental health needs, the addiction issues that they face, that type of thing. And I think that they're more than willing to do that. But also because there is coordination between the city and the county. So there's definitely going to be some financial resources that we need. And there's definitely going to be a need to create more housing options within the city of La Crosse.
We leave it there, Mayor Mitch Reynolds. Thanks very much.
I appreciate you having me on. Thank you so much.
For more on this and other issues facing Wisconsin, visit our website at pbswisconsin.org and then click on the news tab. That's our program for tonight. I'm Frederica Freiberg. Have a good weekend.
Funding for Here and Now is provided by the Focus Fund for Journalism and Friends of PBS Wisconsin.